Hello, and welcome to Season 8 of the Canadian Women's Foundation podcast, All Right, Now What? Gender equality and justice, where we live, work, learn, and play, is the goal, and it makes life better for everyone. All Right, Now What? Remains a space where we ask, how do we move from awareness to action? But this season, we're also shifting the story. Through powerful storytelling, expert interviews, and bold conversations, we'll explore what true equity can look like, especially for those who are too often silenced or overlooked. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and its partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Inuit, and Métis territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.
Hi, I'm Shaganayi Hampram from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Today, we're joined by mental health leader, storyteller, and executive director of Unsinkable, Haley Heckman. In our conversation, Haley shares how her early experiences volunteering on a crisis line shaped her understanding of connection and the quiet power of simply holding space for someone without judgment. We talk about what it means to move from crisis response to prevention and how building community-led supports reveal just how deeply people want to show up for one another. Haley also reflects on her own lived experience. And the moment hearing someone else's story helped her recognize her own struggle, opening the door to healing and a deeper commitment to storytelling as a tool for connection. Together, we explore how stories can act as mirrors, helping us see ourselves more clearly, challenge shame, and remind us of our shared humanity, and why, in a world that can feel increasingly disconnected, care and compassion have to be at the center of how we move forward. Hi, Haley. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being here. I'm very excited to chat with you today. You are a mental health advocate, so I can't wait to get into kind of all things mental health, especially in this sector. So can we start by hearing a little bit of how did you become a mental health advocate? And I am curious when you first even understood what mental health meant for yourself.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with you today. So my name is Haley. I have been a mental health advocate for many years now. I've worked in the social impact nonprofit sector for over a decade in the mental health space in different capacities. But really, you know, I first came into mental health kind of when I was growing up. I've always had an interest in people and the dynamics between them and, you know, what causes us to have certain emotional experiences and how do we process them and how do we grow and evolve over time. And so since I was, you know, as young as I can remember, had an interest in kind of human beings and how we work. And when I was in high school, took a psychology class, was really interested in what that could look like as a career path for me. And so when I was in university, took a degree in psychology, realized pretty quickly that it's strange to do a degree in people without having any requirement to interact with them. Like everything you were learning was through a textbook. And so volunteered at a crisis line early on, really getting my firsthand experience connecting with people directly and understanding the value of having these spaces where people could come together and talk about things that they were navigating, non-judgmentally and anonymously, and just be able to brainstorm and work through with someone else, and in particular, someone that they didn't know and didn't have any expectations of them or didn't have any, you know, previous knowledge or context, just the chance to be able to talk to someone and how powerful that was. And so that really started off, you know, my passion and interest in working in this field, in particular working, it's going to sound kind of strange, but working in prevention. Even though I started my career in crisis, I realized pretty early on that crisis, most of the, you know, calls and conversations we were having with people were people who just needed someone to talk to. They weren't necessarily an active crisis. They didn't need, you know, resources right away. They just needed someone to be there and to hold space and to listen and to be a support. And so that was a real catalyst for me wanting to go into mental health and into mental health advocacy. And then on the flip side, you know, personally for me and my passion around mental health comes from, you know, while I've been working in this field a long time, I was one of the people who found it easiest to ignore the signs of my own struggle. because I worked in this space, it was very easy for me to say, you know, oh, this isn't important, or I can put this on the back burner, or I'm not in this position or struggling to this extent, therefore it shouldn't take priority. And I was struggling for many, many years with my own mental health, in particular, at one point over the course of many years, an undiagnosed eating disorder. And it wasn't until I heard someone else talking about that experience and kind of word for word being in my head and saying all the things that I had been thinking and all the things that I had been feeling, that I really started to process and accept that I needed help and that I was navigating my own struggles in a way that was not sustainable and not healthy for me. And so that kind of started me sharing and opening up about my own experiences and connecting more around the lived experience space and the importance of having places where we can share story, and kind of comes back to the work I'm doing now.
There's so many things there that I was like nodding to, and I took notes on. Firstly, I love your passion. I genuinely can tell how much this is such a passion for you and the work you do. And it's always amazing to see someone really love what they get to do. I did want to talk to, you know, one of the things you said that stood out to me was the irony of when you're kind of learning something in theory that involve people, but don't include people in the process. So I love that you went out to actually be like, okay, what am I learning in a classroom and how does this apply to actual people? Because I think about things like intersectionality that you don't necessarily get to capture when you're just reading or learning about something. And so you talked about volunteering at a support or stress line, a distress line. And I did want to talk about your experience because you started, if I understand, the UConn distress and support line, I think in your 20s, which is very impressive. And I'm very curious how that came about. And also in general, your experience being based in Ontario now, but having that experience of working in the nonprofit sector in the Yukon, because I'm sure support services look very different there and probably gave you a different perspective. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting trajectory how I ended up bringing that distress line to life. Essentially, you know, I was at a crossroads. I had worked in the crisis space for my career at that point as a student. I tried different roles. I went into, you know, recruitment and training, and eventually I took on running that organization, which introduced me to Distress Centers of Ontario, which is the support body that works with all of the different distress centers across the province. And I ended up working on a project where I was supporting a provincial narrative around the work that was happening in this field. So not what was happening at the individual level, but what was happening as a whole across this space. And it was a great chance for me to learn that even though in theory, organizations are doing the same thing, they have very different definitions of, you know, crisis and support and all of these different areas, and don't always capture their stories and their data in the same way. And so that was a really great role for me coming out of university. And I was so passionate about working in that space. And my partner had an opportunity to go up and work in Whitehorse. And I went with him and realized pretty early on, I was continued to work for DCO at the time, and realized I didn't want to be in a community and work, you know, for a different part of the country. I really wanted to be in community. I wanted to get to know the needs. And so I started looking for opportunities in that field, and there wasn't anything. There was, you know, some mental health supports, there was some government run mental health services, but there wasn't anything that was, you know, across the territory that was anonymous, confidential, a phone line, especially, you know, in a space that was incredibly, you know, government centric. A lot of services ended at 4 o'clock. And then, you know, there was nothing really available after hours. And so I started working for a small peer support organization in Whitehorse and started having conversations with people in this drop-in space around the value of having a distress line in the territory, and heard from a lot of people, you know, this is something that's of interest to us, and then started doing some consultation with government and health services and the RCMP and the First Nations communities, and heard pretty quickly this is an area that would be of benefit. And so started down that road of figuring out how to plan it, got some funding from a few different sources to be able to support it, and some in-kind office space from a local architecture firm in the community, and just really went down this path of building something with community that we felt was missing. And one of the most valuable parts of that initiative for me was the fact that so many people came forward to want to volunteer their time to be on this line, and people from all different backgrounds. We had no expectation that you needed to be a social worker or a psychologist or someone with a history in mental health. You just needed to be someone who was open to the training and who, you know, wanted to contribute in a meaningful way. And so we had people from all backgrounds. From one person that stands out to me was a retired miner, like working in mining in the Yukon, and how much time and energy he put into building the skills. And so we initially put out a call for, I think we needed about 20 or so volunteers, depending on the hours we were putting forward. And we had about double that people who applied. And I sat down and interviewed all of them. And all of them said, you know, this is something that I would have really benefited from when I was struggling. And that's why I want to be a part of it. And so we launched that line in 2014 and quickly realized, you know, it needed to have a bit more support behind it in order to be sustainable. The small organization I started it under didn't really have the capacity. So we ended up moving it to a larger mental health organization. And now it lives under CMHA in the Yukon, which is great. So it continues that work. But I really loved being a part of a true community building. And that's something I loved about working in the Yukon in the nonprofit space, is that you see things happen. You know, when you work in, I've worked the last number of years in Ontario and in Ottawa, you know, you're filling a niche and you're trying to explain like why this little thing that you're doing should be, is important to community or how it's having impact, versus seeing the stark difference between nothing and something coming to life in spaces where there's such a great need and where there's just all of these missing pieces. And so I loved that. And, you know, working in the Yukon, I got to be a part of a lot of different collaborative initiatives and work with different organizations and contribute to education programs and curriculum development. Like, I had a chance to really gain so much experience at such a young age, and ended up running a charity focused on neurodevelopmental disabilities when I was 25 as a new executive director. And all of those things I credit for the career I have now, of these community organizations willing to take a chance on me because I was passionate and interested in putting in the time and energy. But it was, yeah, such a pleasure to be a part of.
That's so beautiful to hear about, you know, how that came about and all the volunteers. And I, you know, you talk about kind of the difference of being here and kind of feeling the impact. I do think, and I've always lived in a big city, and I always think the thing, ironically, is even though you have lots of people here, the sense of community is very easily lost in amidst all of that. And so there's something quite beautiful when you're hearing a lot of people who just kind of, to your earlier point, just want to be a ear to somebody else, to listen to their stories. And I think this ties very nicely into what you do now, which is you're the ED of Unsinkable. And I was taking a look at the website, and I loved the framing of like a story could be a lifeline to somebody else. And I was curious, what's a story, and you kind of maybe touched on it, but what's a story that's been a lifeline for you and perhaps has even changed this trajectory with your own mental health?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I love that that resonates with you, because it was one of the things that resonated with me when I connected to Unsinkable. You know, there are two stories for me that have been a lifeline. One of them, like I mentioned, was I was really struggling with my relationship to food and my body for many, many years. And, you know, it was confusing for me actually at the time, because I had gone from being in a larger body to a smaller body and had a lot of validation during that period. So I didn't really, it took a lot longer for me to recognize that I was struggling, because what I was hearing externally was like, wow, you look amazing. What are your tips? What are your tricks? What are you doing? Meanwhile, I was going down this path where I had such, you know, terrible repetitive thoughts, and I wasn't eating, and there was just a lot going on for me. But that external conversation made it really hard for me to see the full breadth of the struggle. And it wasn't until I was in my kitchen listening to a podcast, and this woman was describing kind of word for word what I had been through and her thoughts and how it just took over every element of her life, that I realized, oh, this is a mirror to what I'm going through right now. And she's naming all of these things that I've been, quote unquote, assuming are fine or are normal or are just part of being healthy. And it was her defining those things in this way that really was the catalyst for me starting my own recovery. And you know, that was about just over 6-7 years ago now. I really credit that random podcast episode I listened to for being such a moving force in changing my life. But on the flip side, with the work that I've been doing at Unsinkable, there's, you know, an Unsinkable story that's really stood with me and has been a lifeline, which is we did this series last year called Wavelengths, where we did a group storytelling initiative. So we brought a group of different people together to go through this process of building their story individually, but as part of a group. And we hosted a showcase in June last year in Toronto. And one of the storytellers, her name is Rafaela Mancuso, she shared her story. And her story really focused on this idea of, for so long, she had been ashamed of these different parts of herself, of her body and her productivity and all of these elements of who she was. And through sharing her story, she realized that it wasn't shame that she actually felt. It was shame that had been imprinted on her. You know, people telling her, oh, you should feel bad about these things, or, you know, how could you be okay with this? And coming to terms with the fact that, oh, I actually don't feel this way about myself. I've been told that this is how I'm supposed to feel. And so I've just accepted that as true. And unpacking her story was such a catalyst for her realizing that she could let go of that shame because she didn't actually believe those things to be true about herself. And I think about her on stage sharing that story for the first time constantly. I think about it all the time, of even in my own life when I'm feeling shame, stepping back and asking, like, oh, do I actually feel bad about these things? Or is this how, you know, is it an expectation versus reality that I think I'm supposed to be this way and yet I'm that way? And so the shame is creeping up through this projection versus how I really internalize my own beliefs about myself. So that's definitely been a story that's transformed me as well.
I love storytelling. So I'm such a, you know, I agree with so many things of the power of storytelling. And I heard a few things in there, because one, I think I heard this actually at a storytelling event where someone talked about when you're sharing your story, you not only help other people build empathy, but you also reduce your own shame in holding on to that story. Like, it's sort of releasing it. And then the other thing, and I relate to this a lot, where you're sort of saying, like, you're helping all these folks and you're a big mental health advocate, and at the same time, you ignore your own mental health. Which I think, especially when you work in this sector, it's quite normal to be like, well, I don't have it as bad as this person, or this is real suffering. And I, you know, but I also think part of what storytelling does is you sort of, it's interesting, someone else is sharing their story, but you learn more about yourself through someone else's story. It's all relational. I think this goes back to a general theme of, like, we need to connect with people. We need to talk to people. Because I think it's both, you build relationships with other people, but you build a relationship with yourself by hearing someone else. And it's often easier sometimes when it's not you and you hear someone else. So yeah, I think there's such a beauty and power in that. And one thing I do, I also saw Unsinkable does, is it has programming specifically for young people. And I always love when it's for young people, by young people. And it's very much, you talked about prevention earlier, the work at the Canadian Women's Foundation that I always resonate most with is also with our young people. I think that's such a powerful piece of prevention, the skills today that help build resilience later. And so I am curious, both in running that program for young people and thinking about your own journey, are there things that you do look back thinking similar to that, you know, some of the volunteers from that distress line, what are things that you're like, oh, I wish I had this when I was growing up? What would have you needed, and what you think other people could have benefited from that might have changed how you, you know, handle some of the mental health challenges you were going through?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I so appreciate about our youth programming is, like you said, that it's for youth, by youth, and it's designed by young people and delivered by them. That's something I would have loved when I was, you know, 16, 17, 20, having a space where you relate to someone in a real, honest way. I just find there's more of an openness to adopting the strategies or the recommendations or the ideas coming from someone that you feel connected to, versus if it's coming from a parent or a teacher or from, you know, internet at large, these places where you think to yourself, well, you don't understand. Therefore, what you're suggesting, yeah, it could work, but how do I know it works until someone that I've seen, who I connect to, resonate with, speaks to it? I feel like that piece, that peer-to-peer piece is so critical. I think one of the things that I would have loved when I was young, you know, is an understanding that our mental health is a part of who we are. I think so often we externalize it and we talk about, you know, we talk about mental illness and people who have struggled with a specific mental illness, and there's a lot of need and support there too. But recognizing that all of us are going to go through ebbs and flows and challenges in our life, and recognizing that you're going to need different things at different points in time. I would have loved to understand that better when I was younger, that, oh, the thing that used to work for me when I was 15 is not necessarily the same thing that's going to work for me when I'm 25 in a completely different context and struggling with different things. And this kind of non-linear nature of our experience would have been something I would have loved to better comprehend. And having examples of stories of people I could relate to. I don't think there was really ever an opportunity to hear someone else share the things I was going through when I was growing up. You know, I'm in my mid-30s, and I think back to the early 2000s when I was, you know, the early mid-2000s, like, nobody talked about what they were struggling with. You heard, you know, the only examples of storytelling was, you know, maybe a little bit on blogs and online forums, and then like magazines. And what could I relate to, you know, a famous person in a completely different life circumstance? You know, there wasn't necessarily that place to hear other people who are in similar life situations as you. And I think that's something that's so powerful, not only with our work, but like a lot of organizations, and just the democratization of stories online and people using social media to share the things that they're going through. It's so much easier now to be able to see yourself reflected and use someone's story as a jumping off point for better understanding yourself. Like you were saying, like a mirror of, oh, actually, there's nothing wrong with me. This is something other people go through, or I'm struggling with this now, but it doesn't mean I'm always going to struggle, because here's an example of someone who's been through something similar, and here's what helped them get to where they are now. And maybe 2 years from now, they go through it again, and that's okay, because they're going to develop new strategies. And just seeing those stories would have been really helpful for me, especially like in the depths of my struggle, and at a time where I didn't know that anything was wrong, because so much of what I was seeing was this affirmation that I was doing the right thing. And if I had heard more people talk about what it meant to really go through a hard time with your body and food and these obsessive thoughts, if I had seen someone who looked like me talking about that, I maybe would have gotten to a place in my recovery a lot sooner. Versus the image and understanding that I had of an eating disorder at the time, which was a very specific looking person, I didn't see myself reflected there. And so it was a lot easier for me to ignore the warning signs that I was experiencing. So that would have been really helpful.
I love what you said about the idea that like your mental health is not linear, because if you think about physical health, we obviously understand that, you know, as you get older, I, for one, now need to stretch all the time. I didn't have to do that when I was younger, I could get away with, and you kind of just start to understand like my health is not the same. I have to do certain things, I have to be really diligent on certain parts. And you're right. Like, I think we've obviously made so many strides around mental health by even acknowledging mental health and having normalizing conversations, but you're right. We still talk about it as sort of this fixed thing, and this thing that you address in one go versus a thing that you maintain, just like your physical health. And I love what you said of what you needed, you know, 10 years ago might not be what you need now. What you need in another 10 years will also change. So hopefully those conversations will continue to evolve. Excuse me. One thing you touched a lot, and kind of rightly so, about the idea of seeing yourself reflected in kind of the person telling the story. I think about myself. I'm a huge film and TV person, but one of the things I think about is growing up and not seeing a lot of racialized folks on TV as lead characters, are who are considered beautiful, who are considered smart, who are main character energy. And I know now how grateful I am to kind of see more of that story diversifying. And you're right, it is just being able to see yourself represented. And it also, I think, is beyond that, it makes you think you're part of the society, you're part of the community, you're not just somebody on the outside looking in, you're a part of it. And it's so important, which is why we talked about the intersectionality piece. And I am curious now, with social media especially, you know, we're living on online, offline worlds. And so, you know, we spoke so beautifully about how important it is to have spaces in person that people can meet and talk. How are you finding the online aspects affecting programming, affecting the way we talk about mental health, because there's obviously benefits of it. And there's also, I think, especially when we're talking about young people, there's a lot of concern. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, there's the benefit of having the accessibility of our conversations and stories around mental health being online is that we can reach people where they are. That if there's someone who's struggling and they haven't gone out of bed, they haven't left their room, they're not going to these other spaces, being able to reach them in that moment could be something that completely changes the trajectory of their day or their life, depending on the story that they connect to. So I think that is something that's still so important. But there's the flip side, like you said, that so much of social media is depicted in a very specific way. And I think about, we have a series that we've done over the last couple of years around entrepreneur mental health. And we've talked to a lot of business owners, and many of them have shared, there's this pressure to showcase the successes of your business on social media that nobody wants to see when you're struggling or failing, or you've been up for 24 hours in a row, or your family, you know, you haven't talked to them in days on end, or you're not sleeping. Like, those things, they're not glamorous, and there's the reality that many people are facing, but they're not glamorous. And so I remember talking to this one entrepreneur. She's a young entrepreneur. She started her business with a group of friends while they were still in university. And over the last couple of years, their business has grown a lot. They were on Dragon's Den, and they were on the Forbes 30 under 30 list. And she was speaking on stages. And when we talked to her about her experience, one of the things she said was, you know, I've never been so overwhelmed, because her life had changed so much, and I've never had less people check in to see if I'm okay. Because the assumption on the surface was, of course she's doing okay. She's getting accolades. She's, you know, on paper, all of these great things are happening, these achievements. So she was getting a ton of praise and recognition, and good for you. But no one was saying, hey, this is a lot of change to navigate really quickly. How are you doing? Or how has this impacted you? Just not really fully seeing the whole picture. And so having spaces where people can connect in person is so critical, because there's things that you can talk about in person that you don't always feel safe sharing online. I think about as I was mentioning earlier, the storytelling group that we did last year, and we did another one late last year into this year. And the ways in which people got to know each other so quickly, because they were opening up about these deep parts of themselves that you wouldn't have a lot of venues to be able to talk about in any other spaces. Like, you're not walking into a dinner party and saying, like, here's all my stuff. But in these structured settings where you have this curriculum and you're working through your story with other people, some people come into that process thinking their story is one thing, and realizing through the questions asked by other people and the insights that they get and the feedback that actually my story is about this other thing. And that is so critical for us being able to grow and evolve as people, is having these touch points where we're not just sitting in a room interpreting our life by ourselves. Like, we need to bounce it off of other people, because they see things that we don't see. And sometimes we're our biggest critic, and we don't see the good things. We don't see the strengths. We don't see, you know, the steps forward from where we were, you know, 5 days ago to where we are now, and other people can help us see that. So I think you need the balance of both. But when I think about digital spaces for reaching youth, I think this is a great entry point to getting them eventually to that place. But if they're not in a position to be able to connect in that way, this is a great starting point for introducing them to that conversation.
And also, to just kind of wrap up your point there of, like, we do life with people. And I think often we forget that in a very Western culture, that it's not, you know, you even talked about that person with her successes, and it's the idea of, like, actually everything is, you know, it should be a collective and a shared experience. And we often kind of lose that because of some of the culture around social media and success. And so, yeah, it's a good reminder of, we do this with others, and, you know, others can even help us name things that we don't have the language for. Because really, I think naming and having the language makes a huge difference in how you're able to address something. And so, yeah, I'm a big advocate of, like, get together in a room and talk to people. Well, thank you so much. You've been so vulnerable and so open with your journey and your thoughts and sharing your passion. I love ending the podcast with kind of a hopeful note. Not that all of what you said wasn't hopeful already, actually. But, you know, I think about the state of the world right now, and we're talking about mental health. And, you know, I think it's quite heavy. Times are heavy, and it can be quite hard to kind of do this work. So I'm curious, what keeps you motivated and what's keeping you hopeful right now?
Yeah, I love that question. And I too, you know, when we talk about the work that we do, we always say every story should focus on hope and help. Like there should always be a hopeful kind of conclusion that people can connect to. For me, what's keeping me motivated right now is, you know, in a world where people are really having a difficult time and there's so much information coming at them and there's a lot of like divisive perspectives, story can be the great connector. Like, because even if you have vastly different experiences from someone, there's always something that you can connect to in their story. And so, you know, even if you've never been in their circumstance, even if it's something that you've never experienced personally, the emotional undertones are always something you can connect with, whether it's frustration or grief or pain or loss or desire, whatever it might be. Story is a chance for us to really build empathy, for us to say, oh, this person who I thought was so different from me, actually they've been through a lot of the same things, or they've had the same feelings, or they have the same insecurities, or they have the same doubts and the same worry about the world or their future. And that's the thing that reminds us that we're so much closer than we give ourselves credit for, and that it gives us this understanding of our shared humanity in a way that not many other things do. Like, I think about, there's so much data online and everybody wants to be data driven, and that's important, but data doesn't mean anything to people until it's connected to a human experience. And so that gives me motivation of how do we share stories from so many different diverse perspectives and from communities that have often gone unheard, and help them amplify their voices and the things that they've been through and the strengths that they have, not just the struggle, but the strengths and the hope and the things that they're doing in their community to find purpose and connection. I think that's so critical. And that's my daily motivator with my team of whenever something bad happens in the world, I send a note to my team in our group chat saying, this is just a reminder of why we have to keep doing this. Because if the story is written by someone else with the intention of how they want a community to be perceived, that's where all the harm comes from, is when a story is about people versus that story is coming from people. And that's what we need to do, is help uplift those voices. And the thing that's giving me hope is the people who keep coming to us, like the storytellers who reach out and say, you know, I want to share my story. I want someone who's in a similar situation to me to feel seen. I don't want someone who is going through the thing that I went through to feel alone. That's like this deep desire that so many people have to give back to kind of their past version of themselves in a different person's life. Yeah, that's the thing that gives me hope. We don't have to do that. We could all just be minding our own business and living our life in isolation and just pretending that we don't have a role to play. But the more people who come forward and say, that's not good enough, I do have an important role to play in helping other people, the more the world can hopefully continue to become a better place if that group continues to build their capacity and connect with each other and come from a place of care. I think care and compassion are the number one things that we need right now. So that's what's giving me hope.
Thank you for helping shift the story on safety, leadership, justice, power, and rights. You can visit CanadianWomen.org today to learn more and stay connected. We believe everyone should be able to exist without fear of harassment or abuse. You can help make that a reality. Text SAFE, S-A-F-E, to 20222 to give $10 and support women, girls, and gender diverse people throughout Canada. Small actions can lead to big changes. We appreciate your support.